This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of NPR's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulaby of NPR's Arts Desk with a cold.
And I'm Linda Holmes, writer and editor of NPR's arts and entertainment blog Monkey See, and I have no cold.
You can, as always, subscribe to this very podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
a look back at 70s film icon Pam Grier.
Music from my favorite new African-American hipster string band, the Carolina Chocolate Drops.
And a new book covers the life of the high priestess herself, Nina Simone. But first,
the HBO show Big Love just wrapped up its fourth season. When I'm not alone in having found sprawling, sensational, and bizarre. The show tells the story of Bill Hendrickson and his big old Mormon fundamentalist polygamist family as they attempt to follow the principle and live a modern suburban life. For the past four seasons, Chloe Sevigny has played Nicolette Nikki Grant. Nikki is the second of polygamist Bill's three wives, a modest woman suspicious of the outside world and combative towards nearly everyone, including her own mother, who remains on a creepy, cult-like compound.
Look, you are not sisters.
I know that. We're painting fluffy clouds, and I've sewn us matching outfits.
Please don't wear matching outfits.
Well, she needs something. She's taken a bit to dressing like a whore. And after my sealing, I will be one of her mothers.
Oh, no, you won't. I am her mother. You are my mother. You are her grandmother. Don't push me.
You need to find peace with my pending remarriage. I want your blessing.
Mama, just please have her back on Sunday.
Sevigny recently spoke to Fresh Air's Terry Gross about how she prepares for her character and how much her plain costume plays into that role.
It must be so odd to play a character like Nikki because, you know, she grew up in the compound. She lives in a world where you share your husband with other wives. She has like two other women she shares her husband with. What did you have to do to feel like you could possibly comprehend her? Did you spend any time on a fundamentalist compound? Did you go to Utah? Like, what did you do?
I wish I'd had that sort of opportunity. But no, I read as much literature as I could find, from Under the Banner of Heaven to Escape by Carolyn Jessup to Growing Up in Polygamy. And there's so many titles that go on and on and on. Just trying to wrap my head around that world and where these people are coming from and their beliefs. I tried to read the Book of Mormon, which I didn't get very far into. But I just wanted to approach the character with respect for her and her beliefs. And so I tried to do as much research on my own as I could, but most of that was through different television expose shows and or literature, magazine articles, etc.
So many of your previous roles were, you know, like Last Days of Disco or Party mm-hmm. Monster, which is about like the alternative club world and, you know, Kids, which is about skateboarders. I mean, the scenes that you were part of in the movies are so mm-hmm. absolutely contrary to everything that the characters in Big Love stand for.
I know, and I think that all of my performances in those films, because I'm more intimidated by the big screen, I often keep my performances much smaller and much more natural and subtle. And of course, on Big Love, it's so big and the stakes are always really high and there's always so much going on that I can't imagine what they saw in earlier performances that they would think, oh, Chloe can really, she can run with this. Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's so funny. Like, you're known, among other things, as an icon of fashion, of always being like a step ahead of what the fashion industry is doing and putting together your own very unusual outfits from thrift stores. And on Big Love, you are stuck in one of those like prairie dresses most of the time.
I know, which is funny because it's kind of was always a fantasy of mine growing up. My favorite program was Little House on the Prairie. So I always wanted to wear those looks. When I was a child, I wouldn't let my mom put me in anything but calico dresses. And now, what do you know? Every day I'm in a calico dress practically. So it's kind of funny.
That's very funny. It's funny that you wanted to wear it as a kid, too.
I did. I even slept in one of those white cotton nightcaps. I was obsessed with Little House on the Prairie.
So describe how it feels to be in one of those prairie dresses and how it helps you with the role when you're wearing it.
Well, the look is so particular, especially the hairdo. And every time I'm sitting in the makeup trailer and you know, we begin the poof, it's just the character takes over. And the clothes are very modest, but also very fitted. So that gives me a certain posture and certain attitude, I think, just because I stand up taller and, you know, I have this height in my hair. So I feel like I am taller, you know, with the hair and whatnot. And it just gives me, I don't know, a certain sass.
You can hear the full interview in all of its sass at npr.org/culturetopia.
And Netta, we're going to move from TV over to movies. And as we do that, I should mention that although I do not have a cold, I am still recovering from the Oscars. So
don't keep your performance subtle.
So and as we do that, you know, on the blog, I was talking about the fact that I was able to attend these Best Picture marathon days where I saw 5 Best Picture nominees one Saturday and then the other 5 the following Saturday. And our big conversation we're having on the blog right now with the commenters is about shushing. We had a problem at the screening of A Serious Man, during which one of the very tense moments in the film was ruined by a very enthusiastic moviegoer who decided to make her own loud joke right in the middle of the movie. So if you have something to say about shushing, come talk to us, because I shushed this woman and we have been having a lively conversation about when to shush, whether to shush, and especially how exactly to shush. I actually had a woman today tell me that she stands up, turns around and looks at people and says, "Do you mind?" And whether you are a fervent moviegoer, shushing or non-shushing, or you just appreciate a good film every once in a while, you've almost certainly heard of Pam Grier. The 70s icon revolutionized Hollywood with her depiction of powerful and feminine characters. As part of a week-long series profiling prominent African-American actresses, film critic Mia Mask takes us back to the beginning of Grier's career.
Pam Grier is one of the most popular and well-known film stars from the 70s. As a youngster, Pam Grier grew up on military bases in England and California before her parents settled in Colorado. When she caught the attention of a Hollywood agent, she accepted the invitation to move out to Hollywood and worked as a switchboard operator while taking acting classes and auditioning for roles. Auditions initially proved frustrating as she encountered racial discrimination and was frequently rejected for various reasons. Then she met producer and director Roger Corman. At the time, Corman reigned as the most prolific producer of low-budget horror and pulp movies with sexy, hard-hitting female protagonists. Amid the atmosphere of social disaffection and political activism in the late 1960s and 1970s, Grier rose to prominence as the sexy, scantily clad, inmate-turned-revolutionary in titillating women in prison pictures like The Big Doll House and The Big Birdcage.
Now, where is Jungle? Don't you think I'd tell you before I let this fat pansy slap me around?
Neither racial role model nor simple stereotype, Pam Grier's 70s screen persona was multifaceted. Her characters fused feminist sensibilities, black nationalist radicalism, vigilante justice, and then there was Grier's sex appeal. She created a badass screen persona that carried over easily into blaxploitation, where she portrayed the avenging Afro femme fatale in campy and in blaxploitation movies like Coffee. In Coffee, now a cult classic, Grier epitomized the charismatic, tough working girl that used her brains, body, and bravery to locate and entrap criminals who preyed upon the black community.
Come on now. Look, I ain't gonna shoot you.
Please, don't shoot. I'll pay you anything. $1 million.
Okay, $1 million. You got a deal. I won't kill you. It's your friend Brunswick I want anyway. Where is he?
He went to his house at the beach.
Thanks. That's a present for my little sister.
This was the first picture she carried herself. The story is about a woman who wants to rid her black community of the drugs and dope pushers responsible for her little sister's addiction. Coffee was so successful at the box office that Foxy Brown was initially planned as its sequel, but became a standalone story. Pam Grier is an important icon because she has had a lasting effect on popular culture. Take Quentin Tarantino's 1997 homage, Jackie Brown, as a case in point.
The way I see it, you and me got one thing to talk about. One thing. And that's what you are willing to do for me.
Greer's legacy is greater than the number of references in popular culture. She belongs in the pantheon of radical 1970s film stars responsible for the shift away from women as passive sexual objects to women working as active subjects, propelling the narrative. The crossover success of her public persona demonstrates that she's one of the definitive icons of the 70s zeitgeist.
The heroine of a debut novel is another active subject. It's inspired by the real-life experiences of author Heidi Durrow. She's the daughter of a black U.S. serviceman and a white Danish mother. The book, The Girl Who Fell from the Sky, is about a young girl who moves across the United States to live with her grandmother after surviving a family tragedy. That preteen Rachel is also the daughter of a black GI and a white Danish mother, and as the story unfolds, you discover just how unfathomable her family tragedy was. Her mother took her, her brother, and her baby sister to the top of a Chicago apartment building and jumped. NPR's Michelle Norris asked Durrow about the real-life event that inspired the tragedy in the book.
It was a real newspaper story that I read about 15 years ago. A mother went to the top of the building, and the only survivor of this fall was this girl. I remember reading that and just being haunted by not the questions that the other people were asking about why this happened and how could we live in a world where this would happen, but I wondered what would her survival look like. And
what the girl's survival would look like.
Yes, yes. I wanted to give her a future. I was hoping her life wouldn't be defined by a tragedy. And I really wanted to give her a voice to see how she might grow up.
How difficult was it as a writer to write about a little girl named Rachel whose life sounds a lot like yours, but also write about this mother and this cauldron of emotions that she must have been feeling that would lead her to walk her children up to the top of a building and then leap to certain death below?
It was difficult in that what I learned when I was writing the book itself is that I missed my mother when I was growing up in a way that I didn't understand until really the last year or two. My mom, like Nella, raised three kids on her own suddenly when we moved to Portland, Oregon. And she was busy working, providing for us, making sure that we would be okay. And I don't think she knew about the struggles I was having with biracial identity and living in this new place where I had to, like Rachel, identify myself in a new way that I wasn't aware of. And I, as a kid, didn't have a language for her to talk about it. And I realized as I was writing this story that maybe one of the reasons I was so haunted by this event, this newspaper story of a mother who goes to the top of the building and thinks this is the best way, is just that I'm glad my mom didn't think those things. I'm glad that she actually gave us a chance to go through all the struggles that we did.
You can hear the full piece at npr.org/culturetopia.
People are often surprised that the Carolina Chocolate Drops play the music they do, string and jug band music of the 20s and 30s, a type of music most would associate with a white Southern tradition. But the band members see themselves as part of a little-known black string band tradition. Still, they're not trying to sound like old-timers. Their albums also feature songs by Tom Waits, a cover of an R&B hit, and originals. Rhiannon Giddens, Justin Robinson, and Dom Flemons spoke with Fresh Air's Terry Gross recently about the unknown history of their sound.
I think something that we have that as a new generation of player in the old-time music is that we are educated and we're approaching the music at a emotional distance that just has not been there in earlier generations. Before, you look back at those aspects of history, and people just would say, don't touch that, that's the worst stuff in the world, and that's what's ruining the world. And now, in this generation, we're able to actually start piecing those things apart just because You know, we want to take the benefits and also try to make what's right, or see what actually happened, or what was misappropriate, or what was good. Because the thing about a lot of the black string band music is not much of the music was put down on recording, and that's a very essential part of understanding black music, is hearing it. And you know, just delving into it, you find some things that are off-putting, but at the same time, you got to think in the context of the past instead of thinking in the context of the present.
While he was scheming, I was beaming, and his beamer just beaming. Can't believe that I caught my man cheating, so I found another way to make him pay for it all. So I went to Neiman Marcus on a shopping spree, and on the way I grabbed Soleil and Mia, and as the cash box rang, I threw everything away.
And that's been something in the African American community that's been, it's not something that we've done very much of, is looking back. You know, it's really been a forward push for lots of different reasons. And as Don was saying, I think we are one of the first generations who, I mean, there's still a lot of stuff that's, you know, needs to be fixed. And there's a lot of people that are still, you know, in bad situations. But I think as a whole, we're one of the first generations in the African-American community that has been able to look back without personally being as touched by it. You know, like our parents, they went through the civil rights movement. They, you know, they went through all of these things, and they're really personally wrapped up into a lot of this stuff. Whereas we're of a generation where we're getting it through, filtered through our parents and our grandparents, and that we can step back and go, okay, so what can we glean from this, and what can we take from some of this really painful stuff that, you know, we might want to just kick under the rug? What can we take from it that it's the good stuff? You know, a lot of our early African American history, you know, there's a lot of bad stuff in there, but, you know, there's a lot of good stuff too. I mean, the minstrel shows and the stereotyping, and that's all clearly very bad, but there's a lot of great music and dance, and there's a lot of black musicians and dancers who persevered through the stereotype and who were able to, you know, show their skill and their entertaining, and they were able to do that. And so what we can take the good stuff from that now, I think, along with knowing that there was bad stuff.
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
I want a little sweetness down in my soul.
The sublime, textured songs of the late Nina Simone made her an icon of American music. She was a Juilliard-trained pianist, a writer, and a composer. And in the tumult of the civil rights movement, she also became a voice of action and anger. Author Nadine Cahotas has written a new biography of the singer called Princess Noir, The Tumultuous Reign of Nina Simone. In it, she charts the life of a performer whose music was always an extension of and a response to the world around her. Michelle Norris spoke with the biographer about the importance of Simone's music and her legacy.
I believe she is as important for what she represents as what she left behind, and that is this unapologetic rage at the condition of blacks in America once she embraced the civil rights movement. You know, we speak now of thinking we might be approaching a post-racial era. We talk about crossing the racial divide. Nina had no interest in that. She wanted to confront it. There were points when she said to her black audience, listen to me, do something, get up, you know, be active. And perhaps, you know, one of the sweeter aspects of that is 1969, when she writes To Be Young, Gifted in Black.
That song actually was then became a staple of choirs in largely black schools across the country. I mean, starting at about age six, right, students learned how to sing that song.
Right. And you know what's interesting? Musically, it's not the most complicated song, but that's all right. It was serving a particular purpose.
Mm-hmm. Even the title itself, To Be Young, Gifted, and Black, was a statement of its own.
Right. And in Nina, as with others, it had the ring of autobiography.
You know, when you talk about her activism, she sounds almost a bit strident in the description, but she was very playful at times in trying to bring people along. You hear that in a song like Backlash.
When I try to find a job to earn a little cash, all you got to offer is your mean old white backlash.
The lyrics are very, very angry. But it's almost like a Broadway ballad in her
Yes,
hands.
But you know why you will hear that playfulness? This is a Langston Hughes poem, and you can't do any better than putting to music words by Langston Hughes.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we had today and subscribe to the podcast at npr.org/Culturetopia. I'm Linda Holmes.
And I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks so much for listening to Culturetopia. So long.